This is the Science Behind the Art, where we discuss the insights of the cosmetic industry through a different lens, uniting scientists and artists. We are the New York Society of Cosmetic Chemists. I'm Maria.
I'm Regina.
And I'm Leah. Join us as we embrace beauty and dive behind the scenes of the cosmetic industry.
On today's episode, we have Michael Antonavich. Michael has more than 25 years of experience in the personal care, product development, and product design field, and his career spans background in skin biology and technology development. He specializes in R&D to marketing translation, including claims validation, both in vitro and in vivo. He's an engaging public speaker and product technology advocate with an ability to marry complex ideas and concepts to various consumer needs. Michael is currently the VP of Operations and Technology at Eurofin CRL Cosmetic Testing. His previous roles involved R&D leadership positions at companies that provide finished goods and technology portfolios globally. He's currently on the NYSCC Scientific Advisory Board and has several publications and patents to his name, and continues to be an influential speaker in the personal care, bioinstrumentation, and skin testing arena. Welcome, Michael. We're so excited to have you on our podcast.
Thank you, Maria. It's a pleasure to be here.
25 plus years of experience.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Wow. Let's talk about your career, how you started and how these 25 years have been.
Well, thank you, Maria. My career has definitely spanned many different disciplines. And it all started with working in the hospital. There, I was able to marry the clinical aspects of learning science. I work in a pathology lab where I was doing clinical chemistry and hematology and microbiology. And that experience dovetailed into my experience in the pharmaceutical industry, where I was first introduced to dermatology. I was fortunate enough to work for a multinational company that had a very popular anti-acne drug, and that allowed me to dive into the molecular biology of skin, again, doing research, model development, and from there, I was able to get into the personal care side of business, where I developed more models and really fine-tuned my skin biology experience throughout my career. It's one of those things that I can truly say that I truly love my job. It comes with so many rewards in terms of understanding science, being able to apply the science, and actually being able to provide a benefit to the company that hires me in terms of making products that make it to market. And I think one of the great rewarding things about my career so far, and I hope it's far from over, is that I get a chance to see the products that I've actually developed models for and screening methods for and claims validations for actually on the market. So I'll go to the store with my friends and I'll point to something on the shelf and I'm like, I worked on that. And I point to the shelf and I said, I worked on that too. So that was fun. That was exciting. That was rewarding. And then when you thought you've done it all, you change jobs again. And I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to start getting into leadership roles and being more involved in mentoring the science that I learned throughout my career and teaching others how to do things in this similar fashion and watching other people be successful with the tools that I've learned. So it's been fantastic. Where I've landed now, and where I'm on the testing side of things, it's really given me an opportunity to take all of my previous job experience and kind of wrapping it all up into a package that I can now give to my clients, you know, in terms of a whole consultation package or part of the service of validating safety and claims and making products to differentiate my clients' products from one another. That's really, it's something that if I had to guess what I was going to do when I got out of college, it wouldn't have been this. right? It's really like I couldn't have forecasted this at all, you know. So it's been quite a journey. I really wouldn't change a thing, frankly.
You mentioned that you really had a fascination for the molecular biology of skin, and that's what kind of led you to the personal care side of business. And when you think about personal care, sometimes people don't think of all that goes on in the background. So just to get one claim approved or one claim backed up, it's so much work. It's so much testing. It's following regulations if you're doing an OTC. So I can definitely see how that could be fascinating. But what has been the most fascinating thing about skin biology throughout, I would say, the testing part of your career?
Yeah. I think, well, fascination, I'm fascinated with all of it, actually. I have a quite a unique stance in the personal care side of product development, because most of my peers in the industry are chemists and formulators. And I know enough about that to be dangerous, to be honest with you. And I only picked that up because I've surrounded myself with really good formulators, and I've been a part of projects that I've had formulators teach me their craft. And it's an art, right? And I couldn't put two and two together in the beginning when I learned, you know, why am I talking to a formulator when I just elucidated a mechanism of action which gave rise to a product idea? How hard is it to formulate that? And then I realized it's quite hard, right? Because then you have to think about stability, you have to think about bioavailability, you have to think about skin penetration, you have to think about the half-life, you know, all the kinds of things that formulators have to think about. And not to mention compatibility with ingredients and shelf life and compatibility with product, with the packaging. So I was blown away by that. And so I became more and more interested in it, all the while still holding on to my centerpiece of the skin biology piece. And I got to tell you, there's a lot of biology in product development, which I wish there was more talk about. Obviously, there's plenty of journals out there that talk about skin biology, and there's plenty of conferences and whatnot that I can get my fill of it. But what I don't see a lot of is the interdisciplinary opportunities for chemists, biologists, physicists to come together and actually synergize. So when I'm in the testing arena, I'm always thinking about new model development. I'm trying to figure out how can I see inflammation in a different way? How can I look at the effects of an anti-aging product beyond the wrinkle, or beyond the pigmentation, or beyond the hair growth, or beyond the skin texture? Because what happens is I get so enamored in the mechanism that if I start talking about that mechanism in scientific terms, the marketing people start like rolling their eyes, and they're like, well, when are you going to get to the claim? So obviously the claim is the bread and butter of all products. And the list of claims that you can say is much smaller than the list of claims that you want to say from a regulatory standpoint. So there's another arena that we all have to keep in mind when we're model developing, is that I can develop the best model and the best test or the best validation mechanism on the planet. But if I start saying things that the regulatory bodies get upset about, it's worthless. It's worthless. Yeah. So it becomes a challenge to marry the science with the practicality of the science. And, you know, you look at that from a budgetary standpoint, you look at that from a marketing standpoint, you look at that from a project management time point. I mean, how many projects could one scientist or one group really work on at one time and move the ball? Right. I know there's many people out there that have multiple projects under their supervision, and they would want them all to work. But the reason why they probably have multiple products is because they need better chance of success, right? They're not all going to make it. Some of them are going to fall out. Some of them aren't going to pan out from an efficacy standpoint. Some of them aren't going to pan out from a regulatory standpoint. Some of them will fall down in purchasing because the ingredients are hard to come by or too expensive. So when you say, how did this all come together to help me test things, it's each product, each opportunity creates its own chapter. I mean, they're all unique. And I think if you approach it that way, you have a better chance of differentiating your product from what's already out there. Because if you walk down the aisle in any store that sells skincare products, whether it's Mastige, Prestige, or private label, or wherever you might be, what's another moisturizer, right? How do I make a better moisturizer? Is it a 48-hour moisturization claim? What's next? 72 hours? 96 hours? I mean, it gets beyond belief. I've seen products that claim 200% more moisturization. What does that mean? Am I wet? You know, it becomes confusing to the consumer at the end of the day. So having the right language, having the right approach, not overcomplicating it, keeping it simple. You've heard that probably 1,000 times in your life when it comes to complexity, and asking the right questions. I've been in the industry for 25, 30 years, and I still struggle with that sometimes. You know, you have to balance your excitement with the practicality of being pragmatic and making sure you have the right resources and the right goals in mind. Always. I don't know if I answered the question.
No, you definitely answered the question. You mentioned so many good points that I'd love to discuss further. The first thing I'm going to say is that formulators are rock stars, and that's not just because I'm a formulator, but
yeah. Yes.
I do think it's very important that all the sciences come together. You said it perfectly. I don't think this is a one man's job, one team. All the chemists can figure this out. They can't because they're not marketers, and all the marketers can't figure this out because they don't understand how the raw materials come together and why an emulsion failed or why it changes color or things like that. So I think out of everything you said was very valuable. I think the fact that all the sciences need to come together, and I do too wish that there was more visibility on what a biologist can do in this field. And there's so much, everything goes on our skin, basically, whether it's your face or your body. I think it's very important that there's synergy between all of us. So within testing, I know you've worked with in vivo and in vitro, and I feel like that's like the translation between in vivo and in vitro is like learning a new language. I think when you test something in vivo, it's like you need a dictionary to figure out how's that going to translate into in vitro. So what's been your experience with that, and what's your take on both the efficacy of both those?
Yeah, fantastic question. And I can tell you in my career so far, when I was in college, which was seems like a million years ago, the modality of learning science is very linear, right? You learn A plus B, and then you learn C plus D. And then, so you take your 100 level courses and your 200 level courses, and then you take your graduate level courses. And then if you're fortunate enough, you go on for, you know, higher education and PhDs and postdocs and all that kind of wonderful stuff. Fantastic. You become really, really smart in a linear process. What happens when you hit the world of employment? Yeah, and I don't want to say the real world because academia is a real world for a lot of people. And, right. But when you hit the employment world and people start putting goals and objectives in front of you, and you have project assignments that actually are product related and revenue related. And not to say, I'm not dissing academia. I'm just from focusing on industry, you realize that there's more to it than your project. And most R&D people are at the beginning of many projects, right? So you, if you're a science up organization, the marketing people are looking to you for, hey, what'd you learn last year? What'd you learn last quarter? Can you give us a summary of all of your experiments and what are some of the highlights of where you're going with your research, so we can start thinking about product ideas? Where you have other companies that I've worked for, where the marketing people are coming up with the ideas and they look to the science people and say, hey, can you make that happen? We would like to change the color of your skin based on what you're thinking. Can you make that happen? Right. So it sounds absurd. And usually it all sounds absurd in the beginning until you bring in the people who can realize the possibility. And frankly, most things are possible if you frame them the right way. And I think that's the exciting piece about being in personal care. It's not pharma, right? So we're not held to the regulatory rigors of a lot of things, although there's a lot of regulation, and I'm happy for that, because there's a lot of crazy things that I've seen out there that I'm not sure are a good idea to not be OTC or pharmaceutical, to be honest with you. But nevertheless, you develop an in vitro model to prove a concept, right? So big thing right now is natural products or naturally derived products. You know, I have a pretty good background in herbal medicine, and there are pharmacopoeias from all parts of the world, you know, Ayurvedic, traditional Chinese, American Indian, South American, even synthetic derivatives of natural products. We're all enamored by the word natural, but yet when you distill them down to their active compounds, they're drugs now, or they're molecules of activity. So if I'm looking at inflammation and I want to reduce redness in my skin through a specific mechanism, and I throw a bunch of natural products at it and I find one that works, I'm a hero. But that's the first step of the journey, right? Then you have to reproduce it many times, not just once. Then you have to send it off to the next group for regulatory evaluation. You have to send it to the product, the purchasing group, to see if I can even find it. I've some of the patents that I've been fortunate enough to get approved were literally, they all started by mining pharmaceutical databases and then finding natural alternatives to them. So I'm looking at this one particular a class of molecules, and then I do a little bit of research and I find that, oh, this is an asparagus. Oh, what's related to asparagus? Well, it's in this one or it's in that one. So then I start going to the food market, the suppliers of food grade materials as some of the experimental sources for these molecules in bulk. And then you get this reproducibility, you get this greater hope that this is truly something I think we can do. So it finally gets out of the in vitro world and then it goes into the in vivo world. And there you have to pass your safety, right? So how many things, I could tell you, I've worked on a few dozen molecules that made it that far only to fail when it gets to the human safety part, because it penetrated the skin too fast or at all. I think we're seeing the FDA becoming more vigilant about that with our sunscreen issues with the FDA monograph, right? After how many years of using 16 or so very commonly used sun filters, that now all of a sudden we're concerned about them showing up in your bloodstream. I guess it's better late than never, but what happened to that vigor 15 years ago when these molecules were being developed? Right. So you get to this, you get past the safety part, and now you have to come up with a model system to really demonstrate how they're different from everybody else's stuff. That's the hard part, right? Because there's only so many instruments that can measure moisture. There's only so many instruments that can photograph your skin. So where do you look? I like to look in the universities where people are inventing new machines. I want a laser that can see through this, or a confocal image analysis system that can see under my skin without actually penetrating my skin. So that's where all the Star Trek technology is. Right? I like that kind of stuff, because at the end of the day, that's what's going to differentiate the product. If you look at all the big players in the market, a lot of their research firms or groups have these toys that no one else has, or they have these licenses to use means of exploration that the rest of the industry doesn't have. So that gives them the leg up.
Right. And when we're saturated with a million and one moisturizers and you can get your hands on that new technology, you can come up with a new claim and there you have it. So on that note, what is a technology that you would love to see come to life, or that you've thought, maybe this needs to be improved?
That's a great question. I think I've had that thought probably 100 times from 100 different perspectives. I've had the opportunity to work with technology suppliers that are experts in surfactants. So having surfactants that are multifunctional, safe, non-irritating, they're out there. And what you find is that the formulator, and this is the art of formulation that I so did not appreciate in my younger days, is that certain carbon lengths or certain esters or certain end functional groups on some of these custom made molecules for emulsion systems and cleansers and whatnot really make a difference in terms of the sensorial aspect or the play time and all the tactile differences a formulation gives the user at the end of the day. And another great insight I had was actually going to the store with the end users. I mean, as a guy, I didn't wear a whole lot of makeup growing up. So I don't know what makeup is supposed to do other than look good on someone, right? But when you see it in a package and you have to apply it, or it has to stay in a certain form until you apply it to a warm skin, or if it has to go on over something else. So the versatility in the ingredients becomes something that I so underappreciated as a biologist and not a chemist. So what did I think was cool? I thought all that innovation was cool, right? All of a sudden, you open up a book of what kind of esters you can use in an emulsion system, and there's like 500 of them. So why is that? And how would you figure out which one to use? No one has the time or energy to filter through that. So what I've seen, which is starting to come out now, is this sort of systems approach to analyzing so much information at the same time, right? I'm not going to actually answer that question in terms of what technology I think I'm looking for in the future. What I'm really looking for in the future is a way to make better decisions with all the information that's out there. Like, I'd like to have an equivalent of a Google search engine for emulsion systems, or for sun filters, or for biological actives for anti-wrinkle, right? And I know I'm being general, but you can envision that to ratchet itself all the way down to a specific mechanism, nitric oxide inhibition. Right? Vasoconstriction, vasodilation. I know we're talking drugs there, but these are the things that happen to your skin that people are looking to change. So rather than to sit there and screen hundreds of molecules or screen hundreds of different formulations for the sensorial aspect or the end result that you're looking for, wouldn't it be neat if there was some sort of computer algorithm you can plug all this stuff into and let that be your primary screen? Right, so now I can screen 1,000 ideas in the course of an hour or two, or a day or two, or a week or two, and then focus on maybe the top 10 with my hands and my experiments and my formulators and my biologists and my model development people, because we're at the point now where all the obvious stuff has kind of been discovered. So where's the real diamond in the rough now, right? You have to be really lucky or super focused and on such a differentiating mechanism that those are going to be far and few between to see in the industry. I mean, look what the Korean market did for facial masks. Masks have been around since forever, right? But now they just turned it up like 20 notches, and it becomes a whole new subspecialty within skincare. Why? Because they thought of it in a different way, right? They listened to the consumer, they took the risk, and they actually did it. How many times if I had a nickel for every time I was in a meeting with a great idea that didn't go past that meeting, I'd be retired already, right? It's really incredible how the hard part is the execution. A lot of people have the ideas. So what would I like to see? I'd like to see a better way for research scientists and researchers to fulfill their ideation, right? In a cost-effective, timely fashion. We're not the pharmaceutical arena where we can spend 10 years trying to figure something out. In the personal care industry, 10 years, the trend has come and gone.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
We've talked about anti-pollution for how long? What is it doing for us from a product development standpoint? There's a handful of ingredients out there that claim to be, you know, beneficial to anti-pollution, but are people that live in a city actually aging faster than those of us that live in the country? I don't know. Maybe we should focus on proving that before we start developing products, right? Skin microbiome, another one. Love it. Absolutely love the idea. And there's a perfect example of marrying multidiscipline approach to understanding the benefits of creating a product to manage skin microbiome. But how does it need to be managed to be better? I mean, if I have healthy skin, what's my problem? I understand if I have dry skin or I have atopic dermatitis or I have acne or if I have dandruff, that's well documented that there's an imbalance in the skin microbiome. And then it requires a therapeutic correction. I understand that. But what about the rest of us who just want to have healthy skin? So if I have relatively healthy skin, do I mess with my skin microbiome? Hmm. Some people think so. And how, right? How much is too much? How little is not enough? These are the questions that really are going to take it to the next level.
Yeah, definitely. I think there have been trending topics, like you said. There's the anti-pollution, there's the microbiome, there's the natural. So what are we really doing and where are we moving the industry towards? I think one of the most important things to consider is that as people in the industry, we have our due diligence is to be able to educate those outside the industry to understand as well, like what's really going on in here. Why are we doing what we're doing? And what's the important side of testing? What's the important side of formulating? Just so we can come up with a product that consumers understand why it took so long or what the claims really mean. So I think a big part of that is us educating those outside the industry and within the industry too, those that have been in here for a long time. So, sure. All right. So we've talked about a lot of wonderful topics. I think you've answered everything so broadly that you've covered a lot of what I was going to ask you. So one thing that I did want to discuss is what has been the biggest change that you've seen in the past, I'm just going to stay short, 5 years in the industry, because like you said, if If product development in the personal care industry were to take 10 years, we would be nowhere. I think trends come and go so quickly that I think asking you 5 years is viable. So what have you seen as the biggest change?
Biggest change. I can tell you that I believe that, unfortunately, many manufacturers or producers of skincare products are feeling limited because of potential regulatory and litigation hurdles. That's unfortunate, because for the few that do push the boundaries, and I do appreciate boundaries being pushed, because one of the questions that I always ask people that join my R&D groups and my science, you know, focus groups is, do you live in the box or out of the box, right? Because I don't need another in the box person. I need someone who's going to challenge the status quo, right? Because you're looking to differentiate, you're looking to be different. When you become a leader or a trendsetter or a differentiating force, it forces people to look at, are you doing something you shouldn't be doing, right? It begs the question, like, are you allowed to do that? Is that safe? Does the FDA know you're doing that, right? So it draws attention to you for sure. So what I think has changed is that people have become a little more purposeful in their product design. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing. And I think that's an evolution in the right direction. Fancy free and carefree can only last for so long at a certain level of product development. And then the parents need to step into the room and say, you can't do that, right? I've gone pretty far in some projects early on in my career where I've had management allow me the leash or to be able to run with an idea pretty far, only to get to the point where the next level of execution did require a lot of oversight. And the company felt maybe that's not best for our image, or that might be a little too risky right now, or maybe it's not the right time. Things are being requested faster and faster and faster. People are wanting to see results quicker. People are wanting to get the product to their front door faster. So the world is becoming a very fast-paced place. And as a biologist, and I make reference to this often in some of the courses that I teach, there is something that you learn in your basic biology courses about negative and positive feedback. And there's an aspect to understanding these feedback mechanisms called time delay. Nature has built in every stimulus response reaction some level of time delay. And that time delay allows for an evaluation period, whether it's a millisecond or years. But the important thing is that you have that moment of reflection to say, what should I really do, right? It's not a knee-jerk reaction. It's not a tit for tat. It's not you say this, I say that, or I put the product on, it does this. What we're finding in some of these instant gratification, instant result products is that you get this instant result in a matter of seconds and minutes. But what happens 20 minutes later is that there's a big disappointment later, or there's some negative side effect of it that doesn't marry well with some other ingredient that you're putting on your skin. So I think meeting the demands of an ever impatient customer base is never satiated, right? Even if I could get rid of your wrinkles in 30 seconds, they're going to want my wrinkles gone in 5 seconds tomorrow, or they're going to never want my wrinkles to happen at all. So it's kind of strange that in my career, prevention has always been frowned upon because it's hard to market. I mean, you're in the sunscreen business, so prevention is everything. But look what happens when people were talking about putting anti-inflammatories in sunscreens. Sounds like a fantastic idea if I don't get sunburned from being in the sun too long, but that's my skin's signal to say, hey, get out of the sun, right? Because now you're accumulating damage. So if you take away these checks and balances, you lose sight of the whole reason why we're making some of these products. So I maybe this is a function of my age, but I think our industry needs to slow down a little bit in terms of maybe making claims that are pragmatic rather than boisterous and over the top, mm-hmm. right? I know our marketing directors and vice presidents around the world want to own a category, and they want to own it because they have the best in-class product there is. But what's the cost to get there, right? What do you sacrifice to deliver those types of results? I'm really not sure. I think if you keep safety in mind, and if you keep solid efficacy in mind, like doing an experiment once does not constitute a result. But in our industry, there are not many products that have been clinically tested more than once or twice. Think about that.
Yeah, you've said it. I think it's very hard to try to tell people to have that moment of reflection and be patient in this fast-paced world. And you said it, just like with biology, there's negative and positive feedback. And I love how you incorporated scientific terms into this so often, but it's hard. I think we're dealing with a market that's just going up, 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 up. And there needs to be that moment of reflection, like you said. So thank you for that insight. And you mentioned a lot of quotes that I think would answer this next question, but I'll ask it anyway. You said things like balance your excitement. You said things like fall in love with your job, realize the possibility, and challenge the status quo. I think that's what you want to see when you're hiring R&D chemists. You want to see someone that's outside the box. But what is there anything else you would give as a piece of advice to the new generation?
Don't be afraid of failing. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've learned more from my experiments that didn't work than those of the ones that worked. And don't get me wrong.
I call those successful failures.
Yeah. I mean, how many, I used to do a lot of cell culture in my earlier days. So Fridays was always a big day for me when my cultures came off and I had to do analysis and you know, figure out what the last 2 weeks of taking care of these cells meant. And after I did the extractions and put them through the ELISA tests and put things under a microscope and measured and blah, 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 I couldn't wait to crunch the data on Monday morning. So, you know, Fridays would turn into a longer day than I truly wanted them to be, only to find out that it didn't work. And then I had to sit there over the weekend thinking, well, I'm going to start this again Monday. What do I have to do different, right? And the scientific method says you change one thing at a time. And yesterday, today's data is tomorrow's controls and blah, blah, blah. But what I really look for in people are everybody, listen, anybody that makes it to the interview is smart enough for the job, right? So it's not a level, it's not a point of intelligence or your ability to learn. It's your ability to apply what you know in a constructive way. I've met so many brilliant people in the world that can't explain in any form or fashion what they think or what their science means. And that troubles me, because how can that person get past the bench? And maybe some people don't ever want to leave the bench, and that's a perfectly legitimate career path. I thought I'd never leave the bench at one point. But when I did get a chance to take off my lab coat, I found that it was kind of challenging in the beginning. You know, I can remember one of my first marketing meetings that I had the opportunity to attend, and I was working on an anti-inflammatory product. And one of the marketing people said, "So Mike, how does it work?" And I looked over at my boss, and you know, he gave me the nod, and I was just like, "Well, it inhibits prostaglandin E2, and it works by interfering this, and it's an antagonist for that receptor." And then I can remember my boss kind of putting his hand on the back of my arm, saying, "Mike, just tell him it soothes the skin." And I was like, that was an aha moment for me, right? Because not everybody in the world wants to hear how excited I am about biology, right? Although I am passionate about it. And then I started to teach, and then I started to realize that, hey, you know, I really have all this knowledge in my head, but where it's not translating is to the people that need to hear it. Mm-hmm. So the people that I look to hire need to be articulate with their own thoughts. And they don't have to be my thoughts. And they don't have to be, you know, telling the company lines thoughts. They have to be well-constructed thoughts of their own. And I truly appreciate that, because a lot of times I don't have to agree with what the direction that you're going in. As long as you believe that you're going to get there, then the two of us have the same goal, right? So understanding your potential is the hardest thing to learn when you're young, because you have the desire to want to be something big, or be somewhere at a certain time, or make a certain salary, or discover a certain thing. But what most people don't understand is that you got to fall down a couple times to get there. And those people that can dust themselves off and get right back up and get back on the horse, those are the people, you know, who have the perseverance. Those are the ones that make it, in my book. The people who stay down and wallow in the failure for a while, that's tough. And as a leader in a company, I've had multiple leadership roles. I think some of the greatest satisfaction I've had in a mentorship role or a leadership role is to come across those people and show them that they don't have to stay down long. Like, you can get back up. It's okay. I'm kind of happy you fell down, because now we're having this conversation, right? And then when people realize that it doesn't hurt to fail most of the time, then they're a little more amenable to risk. I mean, when you're in research, if you don't take risk, you don't go anywhere, right? Honestly, I mean, you have to, as a formulator, how many formulations have broken on you overnight? Not to even say, you know, your 4-week stability or your 8-week stability at different temperatures. How many of them you come in the next morning and you got 3 phases the next day, and you're like, well, that didn't work. Maybe I'll just put shake before use and it'll be okay.
Shake, you know? Well, shake well will solve all my problems, right?
So yeah, I mean, like I said, you know, a college degree is a piece of paper that tells me that you're teachable. Outside of that, I want to know what makes you tick. I want to know what you're passionate about. And those are the things that you draw inspiration from. And when I see people really embrace that, I step back. One of my mottos to the folks that I have the luxury of overseeing in my career, I stand behind them when things are good, and I stand in front of them when things are bad. And that doesn't mean I don't turn around and ask what happened, but you got to give them the room to grow themselves, because that was me 10 years ago. That was me 15 years ago. That was me 20 years ago. You know, nobody's born with it, so you have to learn it.
Yeah, I don't think it would be fun to be born with formulation skills, but yeah, I agree. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for all this valuable information. You said so many things that I think are so relevant right now in the market and in this industry. So thank you for being in our podcast.
It's been my pleasure, Maria.
Like what you heard? The NYSCC is here to move cosmetic science forward.
Stay tuned to our next episodes and visit nysec.org for more content.
Hey, Susanna Fernandez here, this year's NYSEC's chair. Don't forget about Suppliers Days, beauty's main event for innovation in ingredients and formulation taking place on November 10th and 11th at the Javits Center in New York City. There will also be a virtual day on Friday, November 12th to make it accessible for everyone in the industry. We look forward to seeing you there. Visit us at nysec.org/suppliersday today.